You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of All That Zazz by Joe Pompeo. Zaslav, also known as Zaz or Zass, otherwise known as DZ, lives for meetings. He loves gabbing, kibitzing, schmoozing, and peppering his companions with questions. Even during the depths of quarantine, he was as much of a social creature as lockdown would allow. He worked the phones nonstop. He took physically distanced walks along the beach. He had virtual hangouts and poker games with the likes of Jimmy Buffett, John McEnroe, Tom Freston, Cheryl Hines, Suzanne Todd, and Shelley and Irving Azoff, among others. Before the pandemic, Zaslav was part of an off-the-record monthly lunch gathering hosted by the New Yorker's Ken Auletta at an Italian joint on the Upper East Side. Zaslav turned it into a biweekly Zoom session, and his office would send the invites. Every other Friday, during the frigid winter months, he and Pam would meet up with Peggy and Richard Gelfond, the CEO of IMAX, under heat lamps outside the American Hotel in Sag Harbor. "We were like the only ones there," Gelfond said. Zaslav's guy-next-door persona belies a social life that mere mortals can only dream of, exemplified by the star-studded Labor Day soirees that he and Pam had hosted until 2018. McEnroe recalled getting a last-minute invitation to dinner with Zaslav and Chuck Schumer, as well as feeling like a fish out of water at intimate gatherings with business honchos like Geffen and Barry Diller. "I think his greatest quality is bringing an eclectic mix of people together in an environment where they sort of let down their guard and enjoy themselves," McEnroe said. Winfrey, who forged a strong bond with Zaslav through the launch of OWN, told me about the time they were wrapping up a meal when Zaslav suggested going down to Soho House to meet Tom Freston and Bono for drinks. "Drinks led to early morning drinks," Winfrey recalled. "David kept saying, 'I'll have what he's having,' and I kept saying, 'I'll have what they're having,' tequila shots. The guy left standing at the end of the night was Bono." In July 2019, the Zaslavs were on Geffen's yacht, sailing around the Mediterranean with a crew that included Winfrey, King, and Lloyd, and Laura Jacobs Blankfein. One night, they decided to screen the award-winning BBC comedy Fleabag, which was made by a production company that Discovery now owns, but which Zaslav hadn't gotten around to watching. A minute into the first episode, the group found itself in the midst of a hot and heavy sex scene. "Pause. So I put my hand up," recalls Zaslav. "I go, 'Whoa.' So they stop it. And I said, 'Okay, here's the strategy. We either shut it off or we put it back on and everybody only looks forward. We don't look at each other until it's over.' They opted for the latter." A recurring theme in my conversations with Zaslav's nearest and dearest was his inveterate generosity. Canceling New Year's Eve plans to spend the night in the hospital with a sick friend and a platter of Nobu sushi. Sending you chicken soup and matzo and fresh squeezed orange juice when you're home in bed with pneumonia. Flying a group of his oldest friends to Rome and hooking up a private tour of the Vatican to celebrate his 50th birthday. "Some of these people had never left the country," said Kritschmar, his childhood bestie. "When it comes to his friends, the people he has been connected with for so long, nothing else matters." When the world came to a screeching halt in March 2020, Zaslav found himself in one of the most difficult moments of his career. For starters, a number of his employees were ill, including three he'd recently been in meetings with. Zaslav dodged the bullet. No one was hospitalized, but some were sick enough to be monitoring oxygen levels and praying they didn't deteriorate. In my years at the company, Zaslav said on our walk, we've been thrown out of countries. We failed at a lot of stuff. We've whiffed. We picked ourselves up. We've had a lot of challenges. The toughest thing was having the employees sick and talking to their significant others or their mom. And that's on my watch. They got sick coming into Discovery to do work. On top of that, Zaslav, like many CEOs, had to figure out how to keep the wheels turning with everyone suddenly working from home. A normal day, I'll go into the office, there's six people outside, and we're just running through stuff. And then I'm running down the hall and grab these six people. What do you think of this idea? None of that could go on. How do you run a company? To stay connected with the worker bees, Zaslav started making weekly videos to send to Discovery's 10,000 employees all over the world. Nothing fancy. Zaslav's youngest, who was quarantining in East Hampton with mom and dad, simply held up an iPhone and pressed record. In the first installment, Zaslav gave a tour of his home office, which consisted of a small desk outfitted with an iMac and a conference phone. The week four video featured a coffee table covered in classic board games and a copy of Tashin's Sumo Size, Illustrated History of the Rolling Stones, Zaslav's favorite band. In another, shot in Zaslav's kitchen, he gave everyone a taste of the comfort food he'd been throwing back, Nonpareil's, Pop Secret, Utz Pretzels, and Ready Whip. I may be gaining a little bit of weight, he said. As I was writing this article, return to office plans throughout the corporate world were being upended thanks to the surging Delta variant. Discovery's homecoming came with an added layer of complexity. In addition to ironing out the plans for satellite offices in 34 countries, Zaslav was preparing to welcome all of his New York-based employees to the company's brand new global headquarters, with the requisite public health protocols and hybrid schedules. Discovery's new home, across the street from BuzzFeed and around the block from a Netflix office, is a 19th-century building in the Flatiron District, with 14 floors of fully renovated loft-style space. That includes a street-level test kitchen and production studio, a wellness center, an exercise room, and a verdant rooftop terrace with views to the northwest of Hudson Yards, where Warner Media has been headquartered since 2019. It's too early to say whether any additional real estate transactions will be required once the deal closes, but either way, Zaslav will have plenty of other integration-oriented matters to contend with. If I were to say what is David's greatest challenge, beyond getting closed as quickly as possible, said Greenfield, the Lightshed analyst, it's that he's got a team of executives at Warner Media who have had a gut-wrenching 5 years. Layoffs, changes of direction, new bosses. We don't even know who's coming and going as part of this new merger. There's been no consistency of leadership. And so the biggest challenge is people and execution. That's David's greatest challenge on day one. When I ran this by Zaslav during our Zoom call, he came back to the same point he'd been emphasizing throughout our conversations. This is a pure content company, he said. It's why most of us came into this business. We didn't come into this business to build broadband. We didn't come into this business to sell phones or to build cloud. The people that came into this business got here because we love telling stories. We love creating content and putting it on the screen, and that's all that we're going to do. So I believe that that mission and that menu of content, as we look at it all in one place, is going to create the excitement and the energy. On Tuesday, July 6th, as the Allen and Company guests were pulling up one by one to the entrance of the Sun Valley Resort, Zaslav stepped out of a large SUV, wearing a blue and white striped T-shirt and a hooded vest. Most of the arriving luminaries had simply ignored the assembled reporters, whose job was to stand around and shout questions that they knew probably wouldn't be answered. But Zaslav obliged, which was lucky for the press, because he was the newsiest participant of the five-day Gabfest, famous for its clandestine deal-making. He stepped forward with a big smile, revealing a set of chompers fit for a Colgate commercial, and stopped for a chat with CNBC's Julia Boorstin. At first, Zaslav rattled off a few brief and unsurprising remarks about how the media industry was primed for further consolidation. Then he uttered the four words that gave CNBC its headline, "We're not done yet." It wasn't entirely clear whether Zaslav was talking about the industry in general or Warner Brothers Discovery in particular, but no matter. Tongues were already wagging. In his industry newsletter, What I'm Hearing, former Hollywood Reporter editorial director Matthew Belloni speculated, "That company feels like a total placeholder to me. The Warner deal will close and either Zaslav or John Malone, Zaslav's mentor and the chairman of Liberty Media, we call Arye, as in Borkov, the banker du jour, who brokered the Warner Discovery combo, and tell him to find another deal. If it's not Viacom CBS, it'll be NBC Universal, or Lionsgate, or AMC Networks, or Sony's film and TV assets. Scale, scale, scale." Zaslav can't think the combined company will be big enough, can he? Can he? I ask him before he had to jump off our Zoom for a parade of meetings with producers and agents and talent and other Hollywood folk. Is there yet another mega deal up his sleeve? Will Warner Brothers Discovery need to get bigger still? "I think this deal will be the first sentence of my obituary," he said, "that Discovery merged into Warner. And the second sentence, it soared." That Night in Ravello. In his new memoir, Baggage, the actor Alan Cumming recalls a whiskey-soaked evening 20 years ago with author Gore Vidal at his six-story villa perched above the cliffs of the Amalfi Coast. Opening photo, Italian Airy. Gore Vidal owned Ravello's 1930 landmark La Rondinaia from 1972 to 2006. Only weeks after the 9/11 attacks, I flew from New York to Tuscany for the wedding of two dear friends. Afterward, I traveled south with my then-boyfriend for a weekend stay at the storybook villa in Ravello of Gore Vidal, the American man of letters, who once described himself thus, "I am at heart a propagandist, a tremendous hater, a tiresome nag, complacently positive that there is no human problem which could not be solved if people would simply do as I advise." I had met Gore earlier that year in New York City when I took part in a reading of his play Visit to a Small Planet. I wasn't really a fan of the play, but it isn't every day you get to meet someone like Gore Vidal. The whole thing was very glittery, with Tony Randall and Lily Tomlin among the cast, as well as my old chum, Kristen Chenoweth, who had played Lily St. Regis to my rooster in the Disney remake of Annie 2 years before, and Christine Baranski, whom I'd go on to have many years of fun with in The Good Wife. Like many people, I was both fascinated and slightly scared of Gore. I loved his stories, and he loved that I loved them. I was flattered by his attention and the invitation to visit him in Italy, but at the same time, I would never want to be on the wrong side of him. He was a legendary drinker, but the few meetings we had were usually breakfast or lunches, with maybe a glass of white wine, the extent of the alcoholic consumption. So, I had never seen the other side of Gore's personality. All of that was about to change. When we arrived a little late after a taxi ride along the Amalfi Coast that was both the most terrifying and most beautiful car journey I've ever had, Gore had greeted us in a shaft of moonlight at the door of the villa, ice cubes clinking in the whiskey glass he held aloft, and ushered us into his Rococo study where Howard Austin, Gore's longtime partner, was completely plastered. "We started drinking at 6, and so your tardiness is the reason for us being a little buzzed," Gore slurred. I asked Howard how he was doing. He peered up at me out of a huge armchair next to the drinks table that made him seem even more diminutive and impish than he actually was. "I'm floating," came the reply. I really liked Howard. It must have been hard to get a word in edgewise, living with Gore Vidal, and so perhaps that gave him the time to hone his one-liners down to such a degree that every single one was a gem. Gore had once described Howard to me, not in his presence, of course, as a wisecracker, and smiled with a rare fondness. And that is exactly what he was, especially that evening. Gore showed us upstairs to our room. Golden yellow drapes hung at the huge windows, and the walls were festooned with slightly menacing gilt eagles. Behind the two voluminous sofas that abutted the marble fireplace was a four-poster bed and books, books everywhere. "This is gorgeous," I gasped. "It was Princess Margaret's room," Gore said over his shoulder, as he stepped unsteadily out onto a terrace with the most beautiful view I had ever seen. We were so high up that the sparkling lights from the ships moored up and down the coast for miles looked like fireflies. There was another little room off the terrace that Gore told us had been the maid's quarters, but now housed all of his foreign editions. "I am published in 62 languages," he almost moaned. "They keep sending them to me. I have to have somewhere to put them." We freshened up quickly. then went back downstairs to join our host and four other dinner guests. Gore and Howard, doing their well-worn double act, were on a roll. I once spent two successive Christmas Eves in Paris in the company of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, Gore declared. Howard, fixing us cocktails from his seated position next to the drinks table, deadpanned. Just lucky, I guess. We all roared with laughter. Howard handed me my drink and winked. There was some little French accordionist playing, and the Duke didn't know the words of the hymns in English. He kept lapsing into German. He was a supporter of Hitler, but I don't think he was intelligent enough to know what Nazism was, Gore continued, undeterred. Next photo, visiting artist Vidal and partner Howard Austin, shown in 1974, invited fellow provocateur Alan Cumming, pictured here, in 2001, to their Ravello villa. By the time we sat down to dinner, prepared by a famous Japanese chef who was vacationing nearby, the mood was quite raucous. Gore and Howard were not very au fait with Japanese food, and at one point, Gore, who had refused chopsticks, forked up a huge mound of the hottest wasabi I had ever tasted and was about to swallow it whole. The table exploded in cries of panic, especially the chef, who had just regaled us with the list of ingredients in every dish and was obviously acutely aware of the consequences of a drunk 76-year-old ingesting this thermogenic condiment. But Gore, who was seated next to me at the head of the table in a very low chair, "Have you shrunk?" Howard had quipped, refused to heed anyone's advice, and like the willful, wicked schoolboy he was, held the forkful of wasabi in front of his mouth, his eyes darting around the table to be sure we were all watching, then swallowed the lot of it. We all waited for something to happen, but miraculously he did not explode. He gave a silent toast with his sake glass, and we all followed suit. But then, under the cover of the nervous, stilted conversation that finally resumed at the other end of the table, I heard him emit a series of weird grunts. Howard was being charming and getting a lot of attention, and I could tell Gore was becoming a little jealous. He asked me what I was working on, and I told him I was trying to finish off my first book, a novel, but with all that had been going on over the last few weeks, I was having a little trouble. "Well, of course you are. You're not a novelist," he snapped, without looking at me. I said nothing. I knew exactly what was happening. Sadly, a response like this was an old standby for bitter old queens of a certain age. They show you kindness that you mistake as respect. Then they bring you down or humiliate you when they know you can't or wouldn't retaliate because actually, you want to protect them, not embarrass them. I knew this was in Gore's lexicon, and I had even imagined something along these lines happening during this visit. In a way, it was a sign that he liked me enough, or trusted my kindness to be that cruel. And also, of course, in a way, he was right. I wasn't a novelist yet. There was a rather long pause that I wasn't going to break. Not with Gore's belly full of whiskey and sake and wasabi, and his speech slurring and his eyes straining to focus. Also, at that moment, I actually held the upper hand. I found Gore boring and wished I was farther up the table, listening to Howard being witty and hilarious, which I knew would be a dagger to Gore's heart. "Write about what you know," he said quietly. I wanted to say that was exactly what I was doing, that my novel was a thinly veiled romanclef about my debaucherously fun deep dive a few years prior, overlaid with my still very present physical yearnings for fatherhood. But I didn't have a chance. He was off. You get around the world. You meet interesting people. You have ideas. Write them down and analyze, he said with great emphasis. Write about this weekend, he continued, looking over his sake glass at Howard. "Write about two men who have been together for over 50 years and yet have hardly ever had sex. Analyze it." Their relationship did indeed fascinate me. They had been together at that point for 52 years and seemed completely dependent on and loyal to each other. But Gore had written copiously about his other lovers, his fear of commitment, and that he had never been in love except once, briefly, with his fellow schoolboy named Jimmy Trimble, whose death, soon after their teenage love affair ended, haunted him and his work. Palimpsest, Gore's memoir, was a pain to Jimmy. I wondered how Howard felt about all of that. I had finished reading Palimpsest just a couple of hours earlier, rushing through the last chapters on the train that afternoon, like a guilty schoolboy cramming for a tutorial. And now, here I was, listening to the man himself recount many of the anecdotes I'd so recently read. It was like having drinks with a living audiobook. When he started the one about Greta Garbo saying to Cecil Beton, that she wished her genitals got smaller as she got older, it was all I could do to stop myself from chiming in with the punchline. This article is from the book Baggage, Tales from a Fully Packed Life by Alan Cumming. Copyright 2021 by Alan Cumming. Reprinted by permission of Dye Street Books, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. Next photo, Withering Heights. The often caustic Vidal, in a 2006 Vanity Fair portrait, would famously entertain guests at his home, known for its transfixing vistas. Gore and Howard had met in the aptly named Everard Baths on 28th Street in New York City in the late 40s, where they had had some sexual contact, mostly in the presence of others, as Gore delicately put it. Gore talked fondly of those halcyon days when men of all sexualities gathered in bathhouses. It was cheaper than a hotel, and they could get blown, and where, he said, you could have anyone. Even sitting down, Gore was swaying now and beginning to needle me. He could feel I was taking him up on his challenge, and by questioning him about his views and past adventures, I was indeed trying to analyze his and Howard's relationship. So he kept throwing challenges back. "Don't you hate commitment?" he asked wickedly, knowing my boyfriend was within earshot. "No," I said, thinking carefully. "I don't hate it." "But you obviously aren't that fond of it by the way you responded." "Well, I was beginning to feel a little uncomfortable, and Gore could tell and was loving it. It's not that I'm not fond of it. When I make a commitment, I like it. I just don't like to feel trapped." Gore's eyes sparkled, and he flashed a vulpine smile, no doubt honing his next salvo. I decided to retaliate. The hunted became the hunter. "You seem to be the one with the commitment issues, Gore." There was a pause for a moment. He slurped more sake. "Oh, yes." Suddenly, Gore reminded me of Tommy, the eponymous hero of my unfinished novel, shagging everything he could and refusing to be pinned down or defined. But unlike Tommy, he had enjoyed all that in his life and commitment. Gore had no commitment issues. He had been committed to Howard for more than half a century. What he had a problem with was admitting his commitment. He then started to talk about never having loved. "What about Jimmy Trimble?" I asked. "Ah, yes." I could tell he was torn, half pleased I had done my homework and read his memoir, half pissed off I was interrupting his lament. "I didn't realize how much he meant to me," Gore conceded. "But you were never really in love with him, were you?" I pounced, knowing the answer already, but wanting to hear him say it aloud. "How could I have been? We were so young. We were just friends fooling around." Of course, Gore would be an exponent of my least favorite American phrase. He was just a teenage infatuation, I pushed. Yes. So you have never loved Gore? No. I suppose I should have been outraged that Gore Vidal had just confessed to me that the central theme of his memoir was a lie. But I wasn't. A human being in his 70s, sitting in front of me, asking me to believe he had never been in love, was far more outrageous. Just as he had never properly acknowledged the commitment he had made to Howard, he couldn't admit to ever having been in love. I couldn't understand it. The usual recipe of shame and self-loathing you might attribute to a man of his generation in such a scenario just didn't wash. He'd been very vocal about his male partners and his female ones. In fact, let's face it, Gore was pretty vocal about everything. His first novel, The City and the Pillar, is very graphic in its description of a gay relationship and caused a sensation when it was first published in 1948. It's not as if he had a problem with admitting he liked cock. He just had a problem admitting to liking the rest of the person a cock belongs to. You Brits are more prone to affection and sex, he said, reaching for the sake bottle. You make that sound like a bad thing, I replied. The subject was closed. Gore was finished. Later, with yet more sake sloshed into our glasses, Gore launched into another elaborate and racy story. Things were getting pretty woozy by now, but I seem to recall this one was about a youthful Prince Philip and the coterie of European aristocrats, on whose kindness he had depended. Howard interrupted with another wisecrack that made us all howl, and the next thing we knew, Gore was up and out of his seat, staggering against the kitchen door frame as he exited stage right. A big, huge baby in a big theatrical huff. He did not return. Everyone was a little embarrassed, and Howard seemed genuinely worried. But then someone suggested a nightcap, and the promise of alcohol numbed his anxiety. When the other guests had left to drive home to their villa, I told Howard to go to bed and that I would clean up. Well, it can't be too bad. He must be quite like me. We have been together for 52 years, he said, his ever-present cigarette wobbling in his mouth as he spoke. I thought it both sad and strangely sweet to be that insecure after all that time. And with that, Howard bade us good night. As we climbed the stairs to the Princess Margaret room, I heard voices coming from the study, where Gore had retreated and Howard had now joined him. They were bickering. Through the open door, I saw Gore hunched over in a chair, balancing a tumbler of whiskey on his knee. He glanced up and our eyes met. "Good night, children," he said sadly. As we reached the bedroom door, I could hear their argument continue. I sat down on the top step and listened. Suddenly, I was taken back to my childhood home, and the many times I sat on our stairs, attuned to the raised voices of my parents, my stomach clenched in anguish, wondering if it was anything I had said or done that had sparked this latest conflict. "You weren't using your brain, Howard. You didn't know what you were doing. You were so drunk," growled Gore, who at this point was barely intelligible himself. "This is not working, Gore. It's not working. Period. I have got to get out of here." I heard Howard leave and start down the stairs to their bedrooms below. "Oh, good," I remember thinking. "He only means he has to get out of that room." But then, after a few seconds, came Howard's final departing cry. "I am putting the lights out now, Gore. And don't worry, in the morning I will be so out of here." "Oh, my God," I thought. "They are splitting up. I was present on the very night a 52-year relationship ended, and all because I was late and they got so drunk before dinner. I am partly to blame for Howard and Gore breaking up. Please note, I had been drinking heavily myself." In the morning, my boyfriend and I crept downstairs, fearful of the carnage we might find. At first, we couldn't find anyone at all, but then a little Italian lady appeared and ushered us out to a terrace overlooking the Amalfi coast and a table set for breakfast, where Gore and Howard were sitting, crashingly hungover. But when they saw us, they perked up immediately. "Wasn't that a fantastic evening?" asked Gore. "I really needed a blowout after the tension of the last few weeks," agreed Howard. Considering I had expected Howard to be gone, his appearance as well as their glowing review of the previous night's shenanigans left me stunned. We sat down, and our breakfast order was taken. Under the table, I absent-mindedly slid my hand onto my boyfriend's. The tabletop was glass, and so Howard saw this gesture and immediately swatted his napkin at me. "Not in front of Maria," he hissed. I quickly withdrew my hand, confused, suddenly ashamed, but not sure why. Already following Gore's advice of the previous evening, I began to analyze what had just happened, and I was filled with sadness that not just love, but tenderness or even touch had no place here, even under the table, in a home two men had shared for more than 30 years. Katie Porter Has the Floor by Maximilian Potter, with photographs by Devin Oktar-Yalkin. In her first 3 years, the Democratic Congresswoman has shot to prominence, leveling corporate titans and tussling with Republicans and her own party alike. She and her whiteboard are just getting started. Opening photo, Katie Porter at her desk in her D.C. office, where she sheltered from rioters on January 6th. There was going to be trouble. That much was certain. The question was, how bad would the trouble get? It was a scorching Sunday afternoon in July, and Representative Katie Porter was about to hold her first in-person town hall since COVID-19 beset the nation. Porter, who represents California's 45th congressional district, had chosen an outdoor venue, a field at Mike Ward Community Park in Irvine, partly in deference to the virus, and partly to be welcoming to parents and their children. A 47-year-old single mother of three, Porter understands the challenges of multitasking when you have kids. By the 3 p.m. scheduled start time, more than 250 people had gathered. Locals came in wide-brimmed hats, toting beach umbrellas. Some opened lawn chairs or spread blankets. Most sat in the grass in front of an empty podium that Porter's staff had set up under a tent. The event was billed as Policy in the Park, and the mood was that of a neighborhood picnic, which made what was about to unfold all the more surreal. Porter was running late, and some in the crowd were growing restless. A few minutes after 3 o'clock, a group holding a Green New Deal banner walked by a small knot of Trump supporters. Orange County has long been a Republican stronghold, until Porter, a law school professor born of tiny town Iowa, came out of nowhere to win there in 2018 and again in 2020. One of the Trumpers, a man sporting cargo shorts, wraparound shades, and a pompadour, started heckling the Green New Dealers, calling them globalist tools, ranting about corporations, conglomerates, Jews. It was as though a tablet of toxic Alka-Seltzer plopped into a fish tank. That's about when Porter arrived, double-timing it across the field. When she finally reached the podium and began to speak, her mic cut out. Sensing an opening, Pompadour and his crew began to shout over her, "Carpetbagger Katie! Carpetbagger Katie!" The yelling, the glitches, the heat, it all boiled into a brawl. Arms swung, elbows flew, a guy pulled a guy off another guy. It looked like a rugby scrum in a mosh pit. Porter was in D.C. on January 6th. Her office is where Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez hid from a riotous mob of Trump supporters, fearing for her life. A longtime friend of Porter's, who texted with her that day, told me, "Katie has always had hope and energy to make things better, to block out the negative and focus on the positive. On that day, I feel like that was the first time the wind was taken from her sails. Now, this." Porter craned her neck, sizing up the scene. Then she took off, speed walking, toward the scuffle. A young male staffer tried to keep up with her, his head on a swivel. You could almost read the thought bubble over his head. Is this really happening? Porter made her way through the knot of people until she reached the center. She put each of her arms around two clearly rattled seniors. Her immediate concern was protecting them, keeping both of them from being pushed over. Porter called for calm. Her sudden presence in the tangle, alone, seemed to startle the bad actors into reconsidering their behavior. A handful of police officers were about a football field's length away. By the time they arrived, she had mostly de-escalated the tension. On the ride home in a staffer's car, Porter couldn't help but dwell on the danger she and her constituents had just encountered. She couldn't help but think of last January. This is the parallel for me between the town hall And January 6th, she told me a few days later, in January, we were unable to go to the House floor to do the business of democracy, certifying the election. Town halls and voting are the bread and butter of representative government, and both of those things in the last 6 months, for me, have been sites of violence. Striding blithely into the center of an active brawl is roughly equivalent to what Porter has done in the halls of Congress. One of my mantras in life is there's no universe in anything where I don't see it could be improved, and that I don't feel for the betterment of the world like I need to insert myself, she says. And that's not always true, and not always appreciated. She's made headlines by acting as a consumer advocate vigilante, matter-of-factly dismantling the corporate spin of CEOs who operate at the expense of average Americans. Her refusal to mince words while doing so, along with her utter working mom normalcy, has earned her a status somewhere between progressive folk hero and unlikely Democratic rising star. In this moment of unprecedented toxicity, she's become a symbol of optimism, an embodiment of the idea that hard work and preparedness and a willingness to stand up for what you believe in gets results. Next photos, Porter in hearings and Porter with staff. Back when Porter first walked into Congress, however, she was a national nobody. The fact that she was the first single mother with young kids ever elected in her own right, the fact that she had flipped the 45th from red to blue, barely registered as a footnote as media coverage of the 2018 election, and the historically diverse 116th Congress focused on the Squad. A couple of weeks after arriving in D.C., Porter had lunch with attorney and former senior Democratic advisor Anne O'Leary. They'd met in 2008, when O'Leary was running the Berkeley Law School's Center on Health, Economic, and Family Security, and asked law professor Porter to be a speaker. I remember her looking really deflated, O'Leary says of the lunch. She was feeling like, this isn't what I signed up for. She got to Congress and was being told, you have to be in your place, stand in line, it will be 15 years before you have any power. She was like, I'm a single mom busting my bottom to be here, and I'm not waiting 15 years to have impact. Impact. Porter despises the word. She's banned her staff from using it. Impact, impactful, it means nothing, she told me. Millions of Americans were impacted by COVID. They lost their jobs and can't afford rent. Jeff Bezos was also impacted by COVID. He got billions of dollars richer. So let's not say impact. Let's be clear about how people are affected. Anyhow, back to the lunch. Over burgers, O'Leary and Porter observed that part of being a congressperson is the committee structure, where members can use the bully pulpit. When you get your time in a hearing, that time is yours. O'Leary says she saw a switch go off in Porter. There are always instructions from leadership, Porter says. This is how you vote. This is what our priority is. This is how you should message. This is how much money you need to raise. And the questions in hearings, you can show up and do what you want. It's like looking around and saying, where is it that nobody is trying to control me? Porter was assigned to the House Financial Services Committee, whose bureaucratically dull name belies its tremendous responsibility, overseeing the nation's housing and financial service sectors, including banking, insurance, real estate, public housing, and securities. Basically, all things capitalism. Few of Porter's new colleagues had any idea how qualified she was for just such a committee assignment. She's already been in the trenches, quietly drubbing Wall Street in one of the most high-profile socioeconomic crises since the Great Depression, but more on that in a bit. Porter was still unpacking her D.C. office in February 2019 when she took her seat for her second financial services hearing. She wore a conservative black dress, her arms folded just so on the desktop in front of her. Seated in the witness chair down in front was a guy with a nice head of gray hair, a blue suit, and a tie that matched his tan. Mark Begor, the CEO of credit reporting agency Equifax, had the demeanor of someone about to tap in a gimme putt on the 18th hole at the club course. At the time, Equifax was fighting off class action lawsuits for a 2017 data breach that exposed 147 million customers to identity theft. Among the data exposed were tens of millions of Social Security numbers, birth dates, and addresses. Attorneys for Equifax were arguing in court that the case should be dismissed. On what grounds? Funny you should ask. Porter began by politely asking Begor if he would be willing to share his Social Security number, birth date, and home address at this public hearing. Next photo, Porter stands near a congressional hearing room, her battlefield of choice. Begor, as Porter expected, declined. Porter had a pretty good idea why, but she asked him anyway so everyone could hear his answer. Begor said it was sensitive information and that he would be concerned about identity theft. Okay, Porter said. So my question then is, if you agree that exposing this kind of information creates harm, why are your lawyers arguing in federal court that there was no injury and no harm created by your data breach? By the end of the day, her time was the talk of D.C. The video clip of her questioning Begor went viral. Only 2 months on the job, in her second congressional hearing, Porter was national news. For her fifth hearing, she came armed with a whiteboard, and a meme and a star was born. The target of her questioning was Timothy Sloan, the CEO of Wells Fargo, which was battling multiple scandals that had cost the bank $4 billion in settlements and fines. Using her board, Porter contrasted Sloan's public statements encouraging investor trust with his lawyer's arguments that said statements were corporate puffery on which no reasonable investor could rely. By the end of the month, Wells Fargo would announce that Sloan had decided to step down. After the Sloan shredding, Law.com dedicated a story to Porter's impact on witness prep. The takeaway was essentially this: corporate counsels needed to do as much research on their own clients as Porter did. Porter's district office is just off the 405 in Irvine, in an industrial park surrounded by high-rise buildings that are regional hubs for some of the nation's most powerful corporations and financial institutions: PricewaterhouseCoopers, California Bank and Trust, Wells Fargo. It's like Porter set up base camp not just behind enemy lines, but in the middle of enemy territory. Porter knows what it's like for a community to be decimated by Wall Street. She grew up in Lorimore, Iowa, about 50 miles south of Des Moines, a million miles from anywhere. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.